Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, water flows on Mars. Will Mars be as big as the full moon this month? Bluefin tuna and biofuels. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Biofuels is just a huge topic. Lots of consideration needs to go into the costs, and there are some very clear benefits.
That was biofuels researcher Amy Wolf of Stanford University. More with her later, but first, Beth Lebwohl joins us for Science News of the Week.
New research published in mid-August 2011 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences helps confirm the idea that life originated in outer space. Certain nucleobases, think DNA, the building blocks of our genetic material, have been found in meteorites in greater diversity and quantity than scientists previously thought.
Scientists at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center report the tsunami originating from the March 11, 2011 earthquake off the coast of Japan caused icebergs in Antarctica to split off, or calf. Icebergs equaling the size of two Manhattans, about 50 square miles or 125 square kilometers, split off Antarctica's Salzburger ice shelf several days after the earthquake, shortly after the sea swell of the tsunami reached Antarctica. This discovery marks the first direct observation of a connection between tsunamis and icebergs.
Vampire bats know precisely where to bite a vein. Scientists took samples of the nose tissue of vampire bats in Venezuela and sequenced the genes. They determined that the molecule TRPV1, which covers nerve endings, enables bats to zero in on body heat. And that's what enables them to find a vein. These TRPV1 molecules can be found in humans, too. They're what cause us to be hypersensitive to heat after sunburn.
After a journey of almost 3 years, NASA's Mars rover Opportunity has reached a new destination on the surface of the Crimson Planet. Opportunity climbed out of the Victoria Crater on Mars in August of 2008. It arrived at the crater Endeavour on August 9, 2011, after a journey of approximately 13 miles or 21 kilometers on Mars. Science interviews up after this. That was a track from the band Monarchs. Their new album is called The Rise and Fall. In August of 2011, the U.S. space agency NASA announced evidence that suggests liquid water flows on the planet Mars. On the line now to explain the findings is the lead scientist who reported the findings to the journal Science, planetary geologist Alfred McEwen. He's the principal investigator of the High-Resolution Imaging Science Experiment on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Now, what are the main findings of your report that you've co-authored in the journal Science of evidence that liquid water has been found on the planet Mars?
What we found are very interesting current phenomenon flows on steep slopes that are very particular about when and where and how they form. And we think we can explain this with the flow of salty water, and we haven't been able to come up with any plausible alternative explanation. We do not have direct confirmation, direct detection of water, so there's still some uncertainty about this.
Okay, so maybe would you mind explaining for us what this evidence is and tell us a little bit about how this Mars orbiter, the high-rise instruments on this orbiter, found this evidence?
Right, so with high-rise, we have been searching to understand active processes on Mars for 5.5 years now, 2.5 Mars years, and we found lots of interesting things, new impact craters, dust avalanches. In the polar regions where the CO2 frost condenses onto the surface, there's a whole suite of active phenomenon. But we haven't seen, out of all of this, we haven't seen anything that seems to require water. All of the wintertime activity from the CO2, it's far too cold for water, for example. Other areas appear to be totally dry processes. Until recently, and an undergraduate student here first discovered this in a project comparing stereo images acquired with the two halves separated in time. This was actually in our data for some years unnoticed. There's a lot of data and not enough eyes looking at it. But what we saw then were these features that are happening now in the summer and had some very strange characteristics. These features recur every year. They have a seasonal cadence to them where they start forming in the late spring, they grow and extend incrementally during the summer. Some flows fade during the summer, others keep growing and are dark. Eventually, they all fade and they disappear in the fall and winter. The next late spring, it starts over again. Not exactly the same, but in the same areas. These are very interesting features. They look promising for water, and further research is needed. That's our story.
What's the most important thing you want people to know about the findings by the high-resolution imaging science experiment, HiRISE, of water flows, possible water flows, on Mars?
The most important thing to me is that we're still discovering new things about Mars that are surprising. We have a lot to learn yet. It's a big planet. It's a complex world. It's a very different world than Earth. And there are surprises ahead of us in really understanding this place and figuring out why it matters to us.
Dr. McEwen, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was planetary geologist Alfred McEwen. We're at Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about what's happening in the global night sky and an email that's going around about the planet Mars. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. So can you believe that we could stand on the surface of Earth and see the planet Mars as big as the full moon?
I will if you tell me.
Thank you. Oh, so much faith. In fact, that is what this email says. The email is going around saying that on August 27th of the year 2011, you'll be able to see the planet Mars as large as a full moon. And now this email has been going around not just this year and not just this year and last year, but in fact, this email has been going around every year since the year 2003.
So, Deborah, is it true, will the planet Mars appear in the night sky as big as the moon?
No, it's not true. In fact, the planet Mars can never appear as big in Earth's sky as the moon. And, you know, if we did see the planet Mars as big as the moon, because it's something that never, ever happens and can't happen, if it did happen for some reason, it would be terrifying to see. It would be a terrifying sight. Nothing like that has ever been seen in human history, nor will it ever be seen. So the email is not true. And in fact, a lot of people know that now. We posted this on our Facebook page this week, and lots of people said, oh no, not the Mars hoax again. But in fact, yes, the Mars hoax again.
Is there any truth to this email? Will Mars be doing anything different in August?
No, but in fact, in the year 2003, Mars was doing something different. So Mars has about a two-year orbit around the Sun. So about every 2 years, we do see Mars as very bright in our sky. That's when Earth is between the Sun and Mars, the distance between our two worlds is least, and that's when we see Mars as a very bright, fiery object that looks like a star in the night sky. In 2003, Mars was minutely closer than it had been since, you know, cave people roamed the Earth millions of years ago. Someone calculated that it was coming just a little tiny bit closer than it had been since caveman times. And that was a very exciting year. And in fact, Mars was particularly close that year. It was an amazing sight in the night sky. Very red looking, very fiery looking, but mostly just looking like a star, nowhere near as big as the full moon.
So, Deborah, can we see Mars in August?
Yes, in fact, Mars is up in the night sky in August of 2011. Because Mars has about a two-year orbit around the Sun, it has a two-year cycle of appearances in our sky. And in August of 2011, Mars is visible in the sky before dawn. It's close to the stars Castor and Pollux and the constellation Gemini, which are pretty bright stars, and Mars is about as bright as those stars. But you really wouldn't notice it unless you had a chart or were looking had a way of looking for it. And in fact, we have charts at earthsky.org that'll show you how to see Mars.
But it will not look as big as the full moon.
Nope, it won't look as big as the full moon. Not in August, not in March of 2012, not ever.
And I'm sure we'll have you on next year to explain this again.
I'm afraid so.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Beth Lebwohl joins us now in the studio with a story on bluefin tuna. So what's happening?
Well, there was a big meeting of world fishery managers in California in mid-July, and it was basically exclusively built all around tuna fish, tuna stocks. And so I decided to speak to a tuna expert. His name is Bruce Collette. He's a senior zoologist at the Systematics Laboratory of NOAA's Fishery Service located in the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. And I talked to him about really the sad state of tuna stocks across the world. And he said the biggest problem is they're being overfished. And he clarified exactly which types of tuna are in trouble.
Particularly for sushi and sashimi, that's what's really driving the market. It's not the smaller species like skipjack tuna and yellowfin tuna. It's the species that are used for sashimi, which is all the three species of bluefins plus the big eye tuna. And the cost of these just keeps going up and up, so that there's a high motivation for people to go out and catch them.
So when Dr. Collette talks about the market price of bluefin tuna, you know, he's not exaggerating. Recently he said one 720-pound Pacific bluefin tuna was sold in the Tokyo market for about $396,000. So because these fish fetch an extraordinarily high price, you know, people are highly motivated to go out and catch them. And he explained that one of the reasons that this is so detrimental is because tuna, especially bluefin tuna, are predators at the top of the ocean food chain.
Right. I mean, these tuna are not only valuable in the marketplace, but they're even more valuable in nature.
They're among the top predators, and this means they're at the top of the food chain, and if you remove the top of the food chain, then another part of the food chain moves up, and some extreme alarmists have said we'll end up with jellyfish because everything else will have been eaten.
Beth, what's the bottom line on bluefin tuna?
I think the bottom line for Dr. Collette was in order to save bluefin tuna, fisheries managers really need to enforce the fishing quotas that scientists suggest and impose.
Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, we interview the world's top scientists. Biofuels are fuels for cars and other vehicles made from plants, and the U.S. is looking to expand their use and places where the plants are grown. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted a study that looked at the potential of biofuels in the southwest U.S., an area where water can be hard to come by. Here to talk more about the study is Amy Wolf, a postdoctoral fellow at the Carnegie Institution for Science at the Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University. Dr. Wolf dropped by the Earth Sky Studios while in Austin, Texas, for the 96th annual meeting of the Ecological Society of America. Dr. Wolf, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's new with biofuels and their potential in the U.S. Southwest?
Well, use and production of biofuels has really skyrocketed in the past decade. Since about 2000, there's been exponential growth of biofuels production. Much of this in the U.S. has been from corn. So ethanol produced from corn has been a really, really big source of biofuels. There's several problems with using corn to make ethanol, one of them being that food prices have gone up because corn has been diverted into these other uses. And really, I think the striking statistic is that something about 25% of the U.S. corn crop has gone into making ethanol that has taken over about 1.3% of U.S. fuel use. So a lot of corn has gone into creating ethanol that replaces a fairly small percentage of the fuel use that the U.S. demands. And so there's been a lot of talk then about where biofuels could expand. And there actually is, the U.S. has a mandate to increase even further biofuels production. And so that's called the Renewable Fuel Standard. And that target is something close to 20% of fuel use in the U.S. by 2022 should come from biofuels. And so that's driving even further expansion of biofuels production. But as I said, if corn is already about a quarter of the corn crop is going to create biofuels, we need to find other feedstocks or other crops or plants that can be used to create biofuels. So what we wanted to do was really look at what the potential for biofuels production would be without increasing the pressure for water use in the Southwest. And so that really takes out of contention a lot of the what we call first generation biofuels. So biofuels produced from corn or soy. And so there are two that we really looked at. The first is switchgrass. And then the other potential is using actually not a crop, but using algae to create biodiesel that could be used as a biofuel. And so for an upper limit of how much switchgrass could be grown in the Southwest, we looked at how much hay is currently being produced. And if you were to replace all of the hay fields in the Southwest with switchgrass, what you would be able to produce is about 3 billion liters of biofuel, which, just to put that in perspective, the Renewable Fuel Standard that I was talking about, the kind of the goal for what the country is aiming for by 2022 is 136 billion liters of biofuels. And so 3 billion liters is nothing to sneeze at, but it's not a huge number either. The story is a little different if you look at algae. So these are algae, the little unicellular organisms.
Yeah, pond scum.
Pond scum, exactly. And they can be grown either in open ponds, as you say, or in closed systems. These are called photobioreactors. And again, these are in pretty early stages of development, but they have some real advantages in that per area land, a lot of fuel can be produced from these photobioreactors. And so where production is relatively low per acre of land with a traditional crop, putting algae on an acre of land produces just a lot more biofuel. And so that's great. It leads to a lot less land conversion. But it's also a very energy intensive, it's kind of like putting up a factory. If you used all the land that we identified, you could produce about 20 billion liters of biodiesel from this land. And again, to put that in perspective of the renewable fuel standard, which is 136 billion liters, you know, that's 1/7 of what the renewable fuel standard is from just these five southwestern states. So that's California, Nevada, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona. There are a lot of potential issues with growing biofuels, and I think there's some real opportunities to start thinking about, with next generation biofuels feedstocks, how can we do this better?
That was Stanford researcher Amy Wolf. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Sleep Good, Mother Falcon, 100 Flowers, Monarchs, Maneja Beto, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up at night. What we don't know won't hurt us. But we don't know, but we don't know, but we don't. What you don't know won't hurt ya. What you don't know won't end a zero fire.